Welcome to Pancreatic Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Philip Philip from the Karmanis Cancer Institute in Detroit, Michigan, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This was a 72-year-old Caucasian male who presented in our tumor board, and we discussed them, and he had a locally advanced pancreatic cancer, which was deemed at the time to be unresectable because of involvement of the superior mesenteric artery.
How was the tumor detected?
The patient presented with abdominal pain.
What was the nature of the pain, and how long did it take them to figure out what was going on?
So the patient had epigastric pain, which was on and off for several months, and then it became more persistent. And he also had some pain in his back in the lower thoracic spine area. And that led to a number of tests. The blood work was essentially not that abnormal. So they did a CAT scan, and the CAT scan showed the mass in the pancreas.
And what was the thinking of the surgeon that evaluated him?
He was evaluated by a surgical oncologist who at the time thought that this patient has unresectable disease because there was more than 180 degrees involvement of the superior mesenteric artery.
And it was the thinking that perhaps he could be converted to resectability?
So the surgeon at the time thought that because the patient was otherwise well and he was a good candidate for surgery, if we can downsize the tumor and also ensure that over the next few months he doesn't develop any metastatic disease or disease progression, then he can be a candidate for a surgical resection, yes.
Could you tell me, I'm kind of curious what you see as the pathophysiology of what's going on in this situation where tumor shrinkage would change the operability? Is it pulling it back from the artery? Is the artery actually invaded? What actually happens to allow resection to be done?
So the major thing about a tumor which is intimately involved with the artery is that even if the surgeon feels that he can resect the tumor, his major concern is whether he's going to leave a positive margin. And that's what something which he was mostly concerned about. Because I sent him to a surgeon who really does a lot of these operations. And he, in fact, the surgeon was out of state. He wasn't in Michigan. And the surgeon has also experience with resections that involve vessels. But the surgeon's opinion was, at this time, I don't think I can do a resection without leaving something behind. And therefore, if we can downsize him, and also if we can sterilize the margins before the operation, the potential margins before the operation, then I'll be much more comfortable in going ahead and doing the operation.
So this man was pretty fit. Any comorbidities?
This particular patient had no major comorbidities. And at the time, he had lost 5 pounds in weight or so. So he was in good performance status. And that was the major reason why we wanted to be aggressive in managing him by multimodality therapy, hoping that surgery would be an option.
So what did you think about in terms of options for neoadjuvant therapy?
In terms of neoadjuvant therapy, obviously we believe in combination chemotherapy, which would give a better chance than single agent. And we don't use single agent in the situation. In our practice, we always start off with chemotherapy. We don't do chemoradiation upfront. And we give the patients the options of either FOLFIRINOX therapy or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Our experience has been that both have comparable chances of resulting in an objective response if you follow the RECIST criteria, reduction of the size of the tumor. Patients are given the pros and cons of each in terms of the side effects, potential side effects. And then we proceed with treatment. We do restage the patient after 2 cycles of treatment, which means approximately 9 weeks after starting the therapy. And then provided that the patient is not having disease progression, in our practice, we continue with another 2 months of treatment. At that point in time, we're more ready to make a decision regarding whether surgery is going to be an option or not. In this particular patient, the surgeon also wanted to have the treatment extended to 6 months because the patient was having a disease response and he wasn't concerned about delaying the surgery. And he also wanted at the end of the 6 months for the patient to have concurrent chemoradiation so that he will have a better chance of having negative margins.
How did he do clinically while he got the neoadjuvant therapy?
The patient tolerated the treatment very well. He was someone who was motivated, so for us, it was easy to navigate him through the cycles of treatment. He did have, however, neuropathy. That was a complication of the treatment when we were reaching towards the 5th or 6th cycle of therapy. It was neuropathy grade 2, so that was significant for him. But he was someone who did not want to really cut down on the dose or abandon the nab-paclitaxel. But otherwise, he did well. It was not difficult to give him the 6 cycles of treatment prior to surgery. And in fact, in my opinion, that was going to be the length of the time almost to give him the adjuvant treatment if he were someone who had surgery first.
So I'm just kind of curious, if he had been younger, 50 or 60, would you still have given NAB-GEM neoadjuvant therapy?
I personally, from my own experience, Neil, I don't really have a major distinction between the two regimens, because if we look at the data from metastatic disease, I would say that the response rates are pretty comparable with the two regimens, GEM nab-paclitaxel or FOLFIRINOX. We will discuss with the patients very thoroughly about the regimens and also the pros and cons of each, especially in terms of toxicity. It is not unusual for patients to choose the one which appears to be having a bit less toxicity. So in my opinion, even in a younger patient, I will give the options of the two, and not infrequently they will choose the one which they perceive as having less toxicity. At this point in time, we can never make the statement that one is better than the other in terms of efficacy or long-term outcome in a situation of neoadjuvant therapy. There's an ongoing trial Southwest Oncology Group is doing, and I'm part of it, looking at resectable disease, giving either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, but we don't have the results of that trial. But in my own experience with my own practice being the source of evidence, I do not think that there is really, in terms of efficacy, a major difference between the two.
And I know there was a poster at the last ASCO meeting talking about this trial. I'm curious what it's like to go through the informed consent. Is it easy or difficult to get patients to go on the study?
Getting patients to go on the study was surprisingly very easy. In fact, the study accrued very well. Whether we take into account practitioners buying into the study and presenting it to the patients, and also in terms of the patients accepting the neoadjuvant approach, and certainly the patients having the option between the two and knowing that they will get a random assignment either regimen. So that trial did very well in terms of the accrual. Based on what we were hoping that we can do, it did better than our expectation.
What about the use of neoadjuvant therapy in patients who are resectable? First of all, are they allowed in this trial? And second of all, do you do that?
So patients who are resectable are really the focus of the trial. So this is the SWOG trial, which is looking at patients who have resectable disease. And in that trial, they get randomized to receive either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. There's no radiotherapy in that trial. And then they proceed with surgery, and following that, they get the same chemotherapy for additional 3 months.
That's the same study or different?
That's the SWOG trial, the resectable study.
So this study then is for people who are resectable?
Yes.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about what happened to the patient after that point?
So after the patient received the chemotherapy and radiation treatment and then was given approximately 5 weeks before he ended up having the operation, the operation went well for the patient. He had an R0 resection, which means that there were no margins left. And in fact, the patient, after the operation, also did very well in terms of recovering from the surgery. And following that, he came back to us, and we put him under surveillance in terms of regular clinic visits, tumor markers, and also doing the scans at regular intervals following the surgery.
How did he do with the radiation therapy and capecitabine, incidentally?
The capecitabine was given twice daily for 5 days out of the 7 day week, only during the weekdays when they get the radiotherapy. He tolerated the treatment very well, and we didn't run into the problems of hand-foot syndrome, which sometimes can be complicating this treatment. So it did really go very well. We didn't have any real issues with him.
How did he do after he got through all this? What was his quality of life at that point?
The quality of life for him went well because he was now free from the cancer. It was removed, and the tests we did at the time didn't show any recurrence for a while. And the only thing was he did have some residual neuropathy from his original treatment, and it took longer than what we expected for it to really improve after completion of the 6 months of nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine.
What happened to the pain as he went through the treatment?
So basically, after starting the chemotherapy, he did have a good response to the pain. His pain wasn't really clear at the time whether even it was due to the cancer or something else was going on with him. By the way, the pain he had didn't require much in the way of pain medications to start off with. And his pain was well controlled on small doses of opiates. And at the time that he started the treatment, we had him started on the pain medications. But within a month or two, I remember he was really feeling very well. He really went through the 6 months of treatment without having much pain at the time. So he's someone who we were encouraged to see that he was responding well. That's the reason why we pushed him to have the operation. He had both subjective and objective response to therapy.
So what was the next step?
So he, after a bit more than a year after that, he presented with obstructive jaundice, and we restaged him, as we normally would do, and there was a mass that we saw in the area close to where he had the radiotherapy, so he can't get additional radiation treatment. The surgeon did not think that further surgery will be in favor of the patient, so we worked him up to start palliative chemotherapy. He had to wait several months because although he had what appeared to be a recurrence, which was biopsy proven, by the way, he wasn't really in much pain, and he was maintaining his appetite and weight and performance status. So only recently, like 3 weeks ago, he started on chemotherapy with 5-fluorouracil, leucovorin, and nanoliposomal irinotecan. And the reason why we didn't go back to use gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel or even like FOLFOX was because of the neuropathy, which he still has some neuropathy.
And what about the jaundice? What was done about that?
The jaundice, he had a stent placed. He had a stent placed to relieve the jaundice, and that was taken care of.
Any other alternatives that you considered besides 5-FU Noleri or would have been considered considering his residual neuropathy?
Unfortunately, it's difficult to use oxaliplatin or back to gem-nab-paclitaxel, so our options are very limited. One option would have been to put him on a clinical trial. I, in my practice, because I work in an academic institution, we have a robust phase 1 program. I do genomic profiling on my patients who have stage 4 disease, and in his case, it was done, but we didn't find any druggable type of mutation. So what the things we're looking for, obviously, are the microsatellite instability, he was stable. We're looking for BRCA1-2 mutations, which he didn't have. And also we're looking for the odd possibility of a HER2-new amplification, which sometimes may be present, which he did not have either. So for that reason, we could not really put him on a clinical trial. We did not have one open for him, and the Noleri 5-FU was the best option for him at this time.
Could you talk about, from your point of view, what the risk benefits were of using Noleri in that situation? Would he stand to gain, and what was the downside?
The most important thing about using Noleri in this situation is that the patient has to have a good liver function test result, because, as you know, it's irinotecan, and it can be, accumulate in this situation. So we had to make sure that his bilirubin especially is within the normal range. Apart from that, we did something else with him because I've given him prior radiation and he's previously treated with chemotherapy. I always, in those patients, start with 50 milligram per meter squared, not 70 milligram, and so I did that also. The risks of the treatment include GI toxicities, again, irinotecan-based treatment, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, a bit more hair loss, and the rest of the side effects that we expect with this combination, like the myelosuppression. For the time being, after having 2 cycles of treatment, because I started 3 weeks ago and had one a week ago, he is not really having any major side effects. In fact, so far he's done well, so I'm hoping that he will be able to tolerate the treatment well. And after 4 cycles, I'm going to restage him and see what's happening to that area, which represents the recurrence.
How would you compare the risk-benefit ratio for Noleri 5-FU to FOLFIRI?
There's no head-to-head comparison, so it's a bit difficult to make a definitive statement, but in our hands, especially if we can choose the patients correctly and start with the right dose in the right patient, we've been seeing a good tolerance to the treatment. I don't see that many of the patients who end up, like for example, in the hospital with severe GI toxicity, dehydration that I've seen in the past in my experience with FOLFIRI. Although again, you're comparing sometimes different populations and different circumstances. But at this point in time, at least in my hand, following guidelines, following my own clinical judgment, I've been able to give the treatment without really seeing much in the way of toxicity.
Can you talk about your vision of what Noleri is, how it's constructed, and what the potential benefits might be of the way it's been formulated?
So being a liposomal formulation of the irinotecan, and if you look at the studies that have been done in animals, but more importantly in human beings, the exposure of the tumor to the parent compound, which is irinotecan, and also SN38, which is the active metabolite, has been prolonged. So there is more exposure of the tumor to the active drugs in the lysosomal vesicles, which are the irinotecan and SN38, as a result of metabolism, which gives a better profile pharmacokinetically of the nanoleary compared to the irinotecan, and therefore the benefit versus risks are, at least based on experimental systems, better with this new formulation. And I think that's what we're seeing. But again, I have to stress the point that patients have to be also looked at carefully, especially pancreatic patients. Some of the patients we have to start with a bit of a lower dose, and then we can build up the dose, obviously. But also one of the things which we have to do is carefully monitor those patients. When I start a patient on NALIRI-5-FU, I see them every week for at least the first one or two cycles, just so that I have a feel for their level of toxicities. But also I do something else, which is I check the UGT1A1, and if the patient has the Gilbert syndrome type phenotype, then I do reduce the dose even more in those patients, because those are patients who potentially can have more accumulation of the drug and therefore end up with more toxicity.
From your point of view, do you believe that this formulation delivers the irinotecan preferentially to the tumor as opposed to normal tissue?
That is really what ends up being an advantage over the irinotecan, because of the uptake of the liposomal preparation by the tumor cells, and also because it stays longer in the tumor cells or the tumor environment, and therefore it's a longer and better exposure to the parent compound and the metabolite. Yes, that's the difference between NALIRI and irinotecan. It reflects on the pharmacokinetics. If you look at the blood levels, you see the areas under the curve and you compare them, and certainly you see more exposure with NALIRI, but also within the tumor environment, which is a reflection of what's happening, obviously, in the peripheral compartment when you look at pharmacokinetics.
So our group did an interesting study recently with about 100 oncologists in general practice, and we reported this at the ASCO quality meeting and also ASCO. And I'm going to tell you what we found, but in order to introduce that, I want to ask you, when you look at this man right now, what would you estimate would be his prognosis?
So this patient, when I look at prognosis, so when patients come to me and they have recurrent disease, I don't really apply the standard rule, which is metastatic disease, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, 11 months. I really look at the patient, and this patient comes back with good performance status. He has only one area of disease recurrence. It's a soft tissue recurrence, doesn't have any liver metastases or other visceral metastases. In this patient, obviously, he's incurable. He will not be cured of the cancer, but on the other hand, he's a patient who's going to be surviving above the average. Above the average, when I say for a patient who has a recurrence after surgery. And his recurrence has been a bit away from surgery. It was like more than a year. So with that situation, this patient's prognosis, he will go on beyond second-line treatment, but the question is what I'm going to give him in the third line. Maybe his neuropathy being better, I can put him on a clinical trial at the time. But his prognosis is better than the average.
I'm curious what it's like to take care of this man, what his lifestyle is like, how he spends his time, and if there are any goals that he has in his life that are important to him.
Exactly. I mean, this is something which I very much take into my consideration in treating patients like this. This is a guy who is a retired gentleman and his wife, and they're both in good health. He likes to travel. Like I do. And he's been doing that before he started this round of treatment. And the plan is for him to continue doing that because he also likes to spend some time in Florida during the winter months. And for me, that's a very important aspect of his life and lifestyle, which I have to really make sure that it happens. So quality of life is really very important. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to touch any drug which will make his neuropathy worse. At the same time, the real problem with chemotherapy in those patients can be fatigue, and therefore we have to get the right dose to the patient that can give him the least amount of fatigue so he can go about doing things that he likes to do.
So this survey study that we did actually was patients with lung cancer, colon cancer, and ovarian cancer, but they all were patients who died. And we gathered a lot of data on the treatments they got, et cetera, et cetera. But one finding that I was curious about, particularly because of your interest in pancreatic cancer, was one of the questions we asked was, to what extent did you, the oncologist who took care of this patient who died, find it rewarding? And we actually asked them to grade it. Very rewarding, rewarding. And interestingly, in these cases, most of the cases, the physician found it rewarding. And they also cited the short-term goals that they were helping the patient achieve. And I'm just curious about your thoughts about that. Do you think, are you finding it rewarding to take care of this man? Do you generally find it rewarding to take care of patients who actually end up eventually dying?
It's a reality that, as you said, they're all going to die because of the metastatic disease. But to me, I really very much enjoy as an oncologist to see patients with metastatic disease, in this case, who will be doing as much as possible or as much as feasible in things that they like to do. I do find it very rewarding, extremely rewarding. I love that. I love to see people who are going about doing things and making not only themselves happy, but all the people around them, family and friends, also happy, because that makes me even happier.
Do you find that taking care of patients like this changes the way you look at your own life?
I do. I'm not young. I'm past 60, so it does. And also, it really gives me more value to my life, more value to every day. I'm blessed to be healthy, and also it gives more value for my relationships with my own family, my children, my wife, my other members of the family, and also everyone I know as friend. And I'd like to also make my life look like everyone I meet every day, even if I meet them for 2 minutes, that it's something of value to me. So really, it means something, because it means that every day we're living on this earth is really a day that we have to value very much, with everything which goes within that day. And also it trivializes some things which normally people make a lot of fuss about. I once had my tooth break during a meal when I was having dinner with my family, and my wife jumped, "Oh, this is a problem. This is, you know, how it is, you know, you break a front tooth." And I said, "Well, it's nothing compared to so-and-so person who I saw today with pancreatic cancer who has unresectable disease, and I know they're going to die of the disease." So it makes me handle the daily challenges and problems of life in a different way also.
Yeah, I'm sure we could talk about this for a long time, but let's get back to the clinical science. And I want to hear about your 84-year-old man.
So this was a very interesting guy. He had gone to another institution because he had abdominal pain and he's lost some weight. And they did a scan and they found that he had a large mass in the distal part of the pancreas. It was very close to the spleen. And as a result, he was taken to the operating room because they didn't find on scans any other metastases. So they did an operation on him. And my reading of the case was that I would probably have not done that operation in a patient right away, in a patient who is 84, had a distal pancreatic tumor. And as you know, distal pancreatic tumors, and this is a large one, have more propensity for micrometastases. Sometimes even when you go in, you see the metastases in front of your eyes in the peritoneum. Anyway, so he had the surgery. And again, this case proves that you have a large tumor, and then you do the operation, you ended up with positive margins. So that's what he did. He had positive margins.
Could I just ask, I guess from your point of view, this was futile surgery that a patient with a short life expectancy unfortunately had to go through. Do you think that in general, investigators who look at this case would agree with you? And do we have any information on how often this happens in the community-based surgical practice?
I only know about it when the patients like this come to me afterwards. It does happen because of two reasons, but the major one is that patients want the tumor to be taken out and the family want it as soon as possible. These are cases where a multidisciplinary approach and a tumor board will really be helpful, because I am not saying that this patient should be denied operation because he's 84. What I'm saying is that it should be taken into consideration that he's 84, he has a large tumor, and it can be a futile surgery. Now, this patient, in my practice, I would have not told the patient I don't want to do an operation, but I would have said we will start with neoadjuvant chemotherapy and see what happens. I mean, if he has a very good response and he's fine for the next 4 to 6 months, we may consider doing an operation. And a distal pancreatectomy is easier than doing a Whipple procedure So that's a possibility. But that wasn't the case, and he ended up with positive margins, which it's not unexpected in a large tumor like this.
So that's the point that you saw him?
So basically, when he had positive margins, and he then, the reflex thing was to give him radiation and chemotherapy concurrent. The positive margins, although you're concerned about local recurrence, but in a disease like this, with this size of tumor, you're still, the whole situation is very much a metastatic disease. So nevertheless, he received radiation plus capecitabine. And then within a few weeks after the completion of the radiation, they did CAT scans, and he has now liver metastases, which obviously he had it from day one, but they were not seen on a scan. But we knew with that size of tumor and everything that he is metastatic disease. So that's the point when he came for an opinion, and he came to see me.
And what were you thinking at that point?
Now, this patient, 84-year-old, certainly he's someone who quality of life is really very important, extremely important 84-year-old who has metastatic disease. And for that reason, I had a discussion with him and the family, and we talked about what are the goals of the treatment, and that's very important. And I made sure that the family, including his sons and myself, were all on the same page and were thinking of the same thing. And fortunately, that was not difficult for them to understand that we're looking at palliation. And for that reason, I gave him options. I gave him the option of giving single-agent chemotherapy like gemcitabine or even capecitabine, or giving combination treatment. Now, in the other hospital, someone had suggested FOLFIRINOX, and I said, definitely no FOLFIRINOX. I would never recommend FOLFIRINOX. So we settled on gemcitabine and the nab-paclitaxel. But the way we started this treatment was to give it to him, number one, every other week, and number two, to also have some dose reductions of these drugs. So the gemcitabine was down to 800 milligrams per meter squared, and the nab-paclitaxel was down to 100 milligrams per meter squared every other week. And we started him with that, and he did tolerate the treatment well. We didn't have to cancel any doses. He went through the treatment, and his best response was stable disease. He didn't have a reduction in the size of the tumor, but stable disease. And then he had disease progression. At that point, we had to have another discussion of what to do next.
And what was your thinking at that point in terms of options? And even at this earlier point, what about the option of hospice, either in general in this situation and specifically in this man?
Hospice wasn't something that this patient and or the family would have considered at the time. So we did not discuss hospice because they were very much keen to go into some form of treatment. One thing which we offer in our hospital, which we have, is the supportive care, which is not hospice, but they provide, say, it's a separate service that looks into managing patients. Pain is the commonest symptom, obviously, but other symptoms that are associated with advanced cancer. So in this situation, we did ask him to consider supportive care, but pain wasn't a major issue in this patient. And that's a very important point, because if this patient had a lot of pain and was requiring opiates, I would have probably pushed him more to hospice than anything else. Because for me, a lot of pain, worsening pain, opiates, in a situation like this would have meant chemotherapy is also a futile treatment. But we discussed chemo, and he went through the first-line treatment after the radiation. And then when he progressed, we discussed again chemo because his condition hadn't changed that much.
It's interesting. So you're talking about a separate supportive care team. Are these palliative care docs?
Well, you may call them palliative care, but...
Well, it sounds like it. It's just that, and of course, there have been studies looking at, quote, early palliative care. But it sounds like you're trying to do the same thing, but take away that word palliative, which I think has sort of a hospice connotation, and focus more on support.
This is more support, yes. This is not, so the hospice is not involved. They see the doctor on a day that they come to see the doctor, and they come on a different day to see me. So, but it's a parallel type of service. And in fact, we like it very much. We find that the patients also don't have any problem in going through that service. And they establish a very good rapport with the patient, and the patient established a very good connection with them. In my opinion, I do believe in this approach very much, and I encourage it, and it's one of the things which I supported very much in my hospital, to have this type of service.
I'm curious, do you send patients to this supportive care team who don't have physical symptoms just because of the fact that they have, you know, a downhill course looking ahead of them in terms of more human support?
Correct. So basically, pain is the commonest symptom, as you and I know, but there are other things those patients have. Fatigue, for example. Fatigue in an 84-year-old and someone who's gone through treatment, fatigue is there. I mean, we can't deny it. And in fact, even a younger patient who starts to go through all these lines of treatment, they develop the fatigue, the depression, the anxiety, and all these things. So supportive care will handle all these things. And when the time comes and you want to transition the patient to palliative care, those people in supportive care have the training and the tools to really make help you to transition the patient to palliative hospice care.
So what is his current situation right now?
Well, this patient, again, the patient and the family were very keen to do more. And at this point, I was debating whether I give him capecitabine, a single agent, or I offer him 5-FU leucovorin and the nanoliposomal irinotecan. I was reluctant with the latter, but then again, I thought, well, this guy doesn't have much pain. To me, I'm very much sensitive about pain. If he doesn't have pain, then he still has, I think, something that we can go by and assume that he may benefit. And in fact, after giving him treatment with 5-FU nanoliposomal irinotecan, he did respond. There was improvement in his tumor. In fact, we didn't see it as much with the frontline treatment we gave him, the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. And the CA19-9 early in the treatment just went down. And now he's continuing on it. I saw him actually this week. He looks happy. He's doing things. He's back to driving, although I advise him not to do that. But am I surprised? Yes and no.
Why did you want him not to drive?
Well, it's just because of his age and, you know, some frailty. But I didn't tell him don't drive. I just said, be careful. For me, someone like himself who lives, although he lives with family, but he wants to be independent, I am not going to stop him from driving. The only time I'll stop from driving for sure, if he's on narcotics or something like that. But he certainly does drive. He's not driving long distance. He's driving local, so.
And what's happening with the tumor as he's been treated objectively?
Well, there is a reduction in the size of the tumor.
Is it a partial response?
It's not a partial response yet, but it's improving. It's getting smaller. But CA19-9 has dropped significantly. I suspect that the next CAT scan, I will not be surprised if we see criteria of the partial response. But certainly it's getting smaller.
How often do you see this, you know, response, objective response to second-line 5-FU leucovorin nel-IRI?
We see it infrequently. Of the patients I've treated, in my estimate, I haven't seen responses more than 10%, to be honest with you. And most of the time, we've seen patients, if they are benefiting, it's a stable disease. For that reason, this patient really surprises me after having this second-line treatment, and prior to that, he's already had some capecitabine with radiotherapy. Now he's responding. So really, this was a nice surprise to me.
So let's hear about your 57-year-old man.
Basically, this gentleman was 57-year-old. He came to me, and he was a very anxious guy, and he already had the tumor in the pancreas diagnosed by a CAT scan because he presented with some abdominal discomfort pain. However, his performance status was good at the time of the presentation, so he was lucky that it wasn't metastatic and he underwent resection. And the question was what to do with adjuvant therapy. And he had gone to several opinions, and the question was whether he goes on single-agent gemcitabine or he goes on with a combination of treatment, or he does radiotherapy or he doesn't do radiotherapy, and all these questions. So we discussed with him the options, and one option was to give him gemcitabine, single-agent, but he said, I want everything to be done. And at that point in time, we had the evidence of the gemcitabine and capecitabine, which was presented in ASCO, and we gave him that option. We wanted to really give him the option of gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, but that study had closed by the time we were discussing it with him. He asked us about FOLFIRINOX, and we said, again, there is no evidence for that, and that's not an option that I was going to offer to him. So based on that, he started on the chemotherapy, and he had to have some dose reductions as we went along with the cycles of treatment. Otherwise, he tolerated it well. There was no question of neuropathy with this combination, and he's doing well so far.
Can you talk a little bit about your clinical experience with this regimen and how you dose it?
So the dosing, we followed the dosing of the clinical trial, which was already published now. The dose of the capecitabine, I do get a bit concerned because I'm having some difficulties with it because of the hand-foot syndrome in our patients.
They use the full 2,500 milligrams.
No, I use lower.
No, I'm saying the trial.
Yeah, but I don't start with that dose. I start a bit lower than that.
What's your typical dose that you start?
With 2 grams.
And did he have any problems with hand-foot or any toxicity?
The hand-foot syndrome, we have seen it. I haven't treated many patients, I have to say, since we started using it, because we also had a clinical trial at the time. We were putting patients on a clinical trial, the APAC trial. So with the patients I've treated, well, less than 10 patients probably, I haven't seen grade 3 or 4 toxicities because I've been starting with a lower dose of the capecitabine. The fatigue isn't really that much of a problem either. And most of the time we've been able to go through the treatment without much difficulty.
Any adjuvant questions out there that are being looked at in clinical trials?
Well, at this time, there are at least three questions. One of them is the combination of the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. That trial has been completed, over 800 patients, and we're hoping for the results in 2018. The primary endpoint of that trial is disease-free survival. There's also the question of FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine, and that trial also has been completed. And I have also a feeling that we're looking at 2018 for the results. So in 2018, we'll have probably 2 studies reporting on that. And both studies do not use radiotherapy. But there's a third trial that has been going on for a number of years. It has over 500 patients in it out of the projected 900 plus. And that's the RTOG trial, which is looking at the question of whether radiotherapy is necessary. In that trial, there's 6 months of chemotherapy, and then patients may or may not get radiotherapy depending on randomization, obviously concurrent with capecitabine. So these are the real data that we are anticipating within the next few years. RTOG will be longer than 2018 for sure. It will be actually much longer than that.
So let's hear about your 51-year-old man with a BRCA germline mutation.
So this was an unfortunate guy who came to see me for a second opinion because his father was also being treated for metastatic pancreatic cancer. And looking back into the family history, there were other members of the family with pancreatic cancer. So he was tested for the BRCA2 mutation and he was positive for it. But he came to me in miserable shape because he had biliary obstruction. That's how he presented, actually. And he also had liver metastases. And it took our people a long time to try to control the jaundice. He needed to have, he still has external drains, one in each bile duct. And that was the best way. Even then, he did not really have a complete resolution of the bilirubin, let alone the liver function tests. So with the knowledge of BRCA2 mutation, he certainly didn't qualify for a clinical trial because of the liver function test being still abnormal. And his performance status was 2 to 3, and he had also a lot of pain. I decided on this patient to start on gemcitabine and cisplatin. Now, why did I choose these two drugs? Because, number one, his liver function test, so I couldn't go into drugs that would be affected by it. But most importantly, I wanted to give him a platinum compound. And I have a sort of a belief that in a situation like this where I want real DNA damage, I might be old-fashioned, I wanted to use cisplatin. So instead of doing gemcitabine oxaliplatin or doing FOLFOX, I decided to do gemcitabine cisplatin because there is some evidence for this combination. And I started him on that. Liver function tests will not be a factor in toxicity with this regimen. And within a couple of weeks, when he came back to see me, he was doing very well. He was much better. The pain was much less. The jaundice was less, so part of it was probably related to the liver metastases. And he was gaining weight. So a very dramatic response in someone who has BRCA2 mutations. Now, we can always make the argument it would have been possible also if he didn't have the BRCA2 mutations. But that was my approach. I was hoping maybe that I can even consider adding a PARP inhibitor to his regimen. But at this time, trying to get a PARP inhibitor, I need to do some legwork to try and to get it on compassionate use basis because I don't know if it's going to be covered by the insurance. But to me, that's really something I will be able to use hopefully in the future if I need to use it when he gets disease progression.
You know, it's interesting because when I saw that case, of course, we've been doing CME and ovarian cancer for a long time, and there we've been talking about PARP inhibitors. There are three of them that are approved, not just BRCA, but on all of ovarian cancer. But in breast cancer, it's interesting now. Like, I'm trying to figure out, are people going to use a platinum agent, for example, triple negative first? Are they going to use a PARP inhibitor first? Or are they going to use what they actually do in ovarian cancer, which is platinum and PARP maintenance? From your point of view, theoretically, you know, putting aside cost and reimbursement, what would you ideally like to do in a patient like this?
In a patient like this, Neil, young patient, motivated, I would have used the combination of GemCis plus a PARP inhibitor. I would have done it upfront, but to me, and I talked to him about it, about the PARP inhibitor, but he wasn't prepared to pay for it himself. So in a patient like this, you see, in pancreatic cancer, when they're symptomatic, I'm still unsure if just using a PARP inhibitor alone by itself will be the right thing. I still want the power of the cytotoxic combination. And I would have, in a young patient like this, I would have put the whole thing together up front to get the best chance of getting him into a remission.
And actually, I guess, at least the approved PARP inhibitors don't seem to do too well when you add them to chemotherapy, so they often use them as maintenance after chemo. The one that I've heard about that does seem to go well with chemotherapy is not approved, and it's veliparib. And I see that you actually have a trial looking at this. There was a poster at ASCO that you talked about this study.
Yes.
Of veliparib with FOLFIRI. Can you talk about that? That's really fascinating. Now, this is not just BRCA germline, right?
No. But we're collecting the data. So basically, you're combining it, you can make veliparib with a combination that also is a DNA damaging. The irinotecan is, in fact, a DNA damaging agent if you look at it, the way the mechanism of action of the drug. So that's a study in patients who have gemcitabine-based therapy in the frontline, metastatic pancreatic cancer, gemcitabine-based chemotherapy frontline. They fail. And then in the second line, we have this study which is looking at FOLFIRI plus minus veliparib. So that's a trial which we're also collecting information prospectively on the BRCA status and also other biomarkers which you're looking at in collaboration with the University of Washington. In that trial, we're not selecting patients, but we're collecting the data. And it's also based on phase one study that was done by Jordan Berlin a few years ago, which showed some interesting signal of activity. So that will be our interesting trial to see whether in the second line or in any line subsequently we can study further if we see a signal for a PARP inhibitor, irrespective of their DNA status, mutational status.
What do we know right now at this point about the activity of PARP inhibitors in patients with pancreatic cancer, either BRCA germline or not?
I don't have any data on patients who don't have BRCA mutations. However, there is evidence published in the JCO. This was approximately 3 years ago when they tested PARP inhibitor in patients who had BRCA2 mutations. The study included several tumor types, even including like prostate cancer. And they showed that in patients who have pancreatic cancer, single-agent PARP inhibitor produced a good stabilization of the disease. I don't think that we can see a good shrinkage, but we can see prolonged stabilization of the disease, which takes me back to this patient. If I see this patient responding, continue to respond well, after a while, one of the things I was thinking of was to stop the gemcitabine cisplatin because I don't want to continue with it for a very long time, and then maintain him on a PARP inhibitor, which may also give him a good quality of life to go and enjoy his family. He's a young guy. So that would be one strategy I was thinking of in this particular patient, is to give chemotherapy for a finite number of cycles and then move on to maintenance with a PARP inhibitor. It's not part of the clinical trial. It's not evidence-based if you want, but to me, clinically, it makes sense.
So I'm hearing prostate cancer investigators say, we're testing for BRCA germline. If they're positive, we'll consider. We try to get a PARP inhibitor off study. They are telling me they see some responses. Do you think that BRCA germline, from the point of view of PARP inhibitors, is going to start to follow sort of the MSI path? We saw now for the first time an FDA approval based on a biomarker with MSI, not a specific tumor site. Do you think BRCA germline and PARP inhibitors is maybe going to go in the same direction?
In my opinion, it should, because there is a percentage. I was just looking at an article published very recently in Clinical Cancer Research in pancreatic cancer from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group, and they have a 4%. A 4% chance of having BRCA2 mutation and possibly benefiting from or having even a 50% benefit or a 60% benefit from a PARP inhibitor is something worthwhile, and I think we should be considering. In my practice, I do check for BRCA2 mutations in patients with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and I think at some point we are going to start using it as a routine. For that reason, I believe that it has to be. I would strongly support the FDA to consider such a approval.
It's interesting. We're seeing more and more of these small subset, 4% of pancreatic cancer. I just flashed on to ALK in non-small cell lung cancer, 4%. Of course, the denominator is higher, but the point is, it seems like now we're starting to look for smaller biomarkers, which sort of leads into the other thing I want to ask you about, which is the whole issue of biomarkers and targeted therapy of pancreatic cancer. Can you talk about some of the novel agents and strategies that you're most excited about?
So in pancreatic cancer, we talked about the BRCA2 mutations, but we have to really put in the context that when you talk about BRCA2 mutations, it's within the context of DNA repair. But there's more than that. I mean, I recently saw a patient with one of my patients who I had treated before, and this is a related cancer, it's biliary cancer, who had ATM mutation. And this guy had surprisingly a very long, and he continues to be in remission years after started the treatment. So these are rare mutations that are under the umbrella of the DNA repair. So I would like to stress the point that it's beyond BRCA2. It has other, and these are the group of patients where we can benefit them, and that's based on science. The other area which is of interest is looking at the stromal targeting agents. We had some problems, challenges with Hedgehog, but the other one which is now currently being tested is the hyaluronan, or HA short, and patients who have tumors that stain positive for the HA do seem to benefit from adding a drug called pegylated PEG-PH20 when combined with chemotherapy. That seems to be, from a pilot study, to benefit the patients in terms of prolonging progression-free survival. And that concept has now gone into a phase 3 trial in patients who are selected for overexpression of the HA. So that's an area which is really also important to keep track of, because that's showing some benefit. The other pilot trial that showed benefit has now gone to a large, very large phase 3 trial is targeting STAT3, which we think that we're targeting in the stem cells, pancreatic cancer stem cells. And there's a study now which is ongoing with napabucasin. It's a global trial. So that's something which looks interesting, looks promising, but we have to wait, obviously, for the results. There are other approaches that are being done. One of them is try to target the myeloid cells that travel all the way from the bone marrow to the tumor environment. And once they get there, they make the tumor environment immunosuppressive, they make the tumor environment more aggressive, and there is some evidence that if you target the signaling in those cells, trying to inhibit them, you may improve the outcome of chemotherapy. And CCR2 inhibitor has been tested, and there was a pilot trial published in the Lancet Oncology last year, which is of interest, which is also going into some randomized trials. There's also other approaches which are looking into more novel approaches like targeting metabolism, and there's also some other agents like dual targeting of the HER2 and ERBB3 as a way of trying to control the resistance to treatment. So a number of approaches are currently being pursued, but I would say the ones which are in phase 3 trials will be the ones obviously we'll be looking at in terms of some interesting results within the next 2-3 years. Namely the PARP inhibitors, because there are international trials now looking at PARP inhibitors in frontline treatment and also in maintenance. And also I mentioned the pegylated PEG-PH20 and also the anti-STAT3. These are the ones which are probably a bit more advanced in their development. But there might be others which come in even before these if we see some very strong signals, even in phase 1 trials.
So just a couple of follow-up questions. This PEG-PH20, can you talk a little bit more about your vision about how it works against the tumor and the tolerability toxicity ratio?
So basically, the PEG-PH20 is a simple molecule. I mean, we know that there's an enzyme called hyaluronidase, which breaks down hyaluronan. Hyaluronan is a stromal component. And I personally, if I want to make it simple, I call it, it's a biological cement, which really works to stop the drugs from, it's around the tumor cells, therefore it limits the access of the active drugs to the cancer cells. It also contributes to the dense stroma we see in pancreatic cancer. It also probably contributes to the hypovascularity, which is another way of limiting drugs to go into the tumor cells. The hyaluronidase is an enzyme that simply breaks down the hyaluronan. It digests it. But if you give it to people IV, the enzyme will be cleared within seconds, and therefore you have to formulate it, and this is the pegylated form, which is the drug. And when you give it with chemotherapy, there is evidence, preclinical evidence, that it improves the delivery of the drugs to the cancer cells, and there are two very good papers on that. So that led to the clinical trial. Now, unfortunately, one of the side effects that showed up in the clinical trial earlier on was increasing the frequency of venous thromboembolic events. Well, those patients have more of that, we know, pancreatic cancer, but it was further significantly increased. And a way to mitigate that, you add a low molecular heparin, which showed if you do that, then you can bring the risk pretty much close to baseline. So that was the side effect which was really unique about this class of agents.
Any speculation about why you see this thrombotic complications?
At this time, no one really has come up with a good explanation for it, no.
And in terms of the napobucosin, what do you see there, again, in terms of anti-tumor activity in pancreatic and other cancers? And again, what kinds of tolerability issues? I've heard things about GI problems.
GI problems, but again, you have to remember it's not used on its own, used with chemotherapy. Does it do something to enhance the toxicity in normal cells as a possibility? But looking at the presentations, I was recently in the Barcelona meeting, the World GI meeting, and I heard a couple of presentations, one on pancreatic cancer and one was in colorectal cancer, both advanced disease. And I didn't get the impression that the toxicity was really increased by much. So I would say it adds maybe some, but it certainly doesn't make it a very difficult drug to use, at least based on the data presented. And certainly in pancreatic cancer study, it was well tolerated.
So of course, I have to ask you about immunotherapy and particularly checkpoint inhibitors.
So the unique situation with pancreatic cancer, which is really not unique to it, but shared by some other cancers, is the fact that the microenvironment in the pancreatic cancer is very immunosuppressive. It has lots of players there that try to block the function of the T lymphocytes to kill the cancer cells. But also there are fewer T lymphocytes in that environment. And there are T regulatory cells, Tregs, which do that. There are the myeloid cells, which I discussed earlier. They come all the way there to do that. And also the other thing is that it's a hypovascular, so large molecules may not really have the freedom of going around within the tumor environment. For that reason, at this point in time, PD-1, PD-L1 inhibition or inhibitors haven't really shown any real activity in this disease.
To finish out, could you review the clinical evidence we have that guides your treatment approach for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic pancreatic cancer?
So basically, we do have 4 randomized phase 3 trials that were potentially changing practice in the treatment of advanced pancreatic cancer. The first one, gemcitabine versus bolus 5-FU, and then we moved into another trial which was combining erlotinib, the tyrosine kinase inhibitor targeting EGFR plus gemcitabine, and that produced a marginal benefit, and I call it marginal because at this point in time, people simply do not use this combination because of the benefit versus the risk is not considered to be worthwhile. And then we had the FOLFIRINOX trial, which showed in good performance status patients that there was a significant improvement in the progression-free and overall survival. And then we had gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel combined with gemcitabine versus gemcitabine, and that also showed an improvement in survival. If we look at the improvement in survival, they may look not the same and a bit less with the gem-nab-paclitaxel, but there were studies which were done in different conditions and also patient numbers. The FOLFIRINOX trial was done only in select institutions in France, whereas the other was done globally. So if you look at the efficacy based on the objective response rate between the two regimens, we see that it's fairly comparable. As I mentioned, the survival might be a bit longer in patients with FOLFIRINOX, but we have to again, factor in the conditions and the type of the patients who went into the trial. In patients who were on the FOLFIRINOX trial, they were all 0 or 1. In patients on the gemcitabine, not paclitaxel, some of the patients were having also performance status 2. The safety profile is a bit slightly different in a way that there's more GI toxicity in patients who underwent the FOLFIRINOX treatment. And from my own experience, there's more hospital admissions because of the GI toxicity and the dehydration that can happen. Otherwise, I think if we look at the other side effects, they're comparable. Now, what happened now is that the clinical trials that are being done globally, the platform that is being used for combining with target agents has now been, in the majority of the cases, more than 90-95% gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Because of 2 reasons. One is it's a robust regulatory standard, and the second thing is that the perception that combining drugs with gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel is easier. So the guidelines at this point in time, if you look at both NCCN and also the European guidelines, they do recommend that for the frontline treatment, you do consider either gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel or FOLFIRINOX. There's no real preference here because these are the ones that should be presented to the patient as options. And there's a list of other combinations, but at this point in time, as an oncologist, I practice in an academic institution, and also based on the experience of the people in the community, the real 2 regimens that are being offered to patients are those. There are ways that we can improve the tolerance of the treatment. There are things that we can do. One is to do dose reduction. The other one is to change the schedule to every other week. And again, depends on the side effect that you're dealing with and the type of the patient. Certainly, if you have fatigue, then every other week helps with the gem-nab-paclitaxel. Reducing the dose is always an option. And there are different things we can do for patients. But if, again, it should be very highly personalized. Based on the initial presentation and then when they went back and looked at their results, the MPACT trial people found that if you do those reductions, it really does not become detrimental to the overall survival. In fact, there's a very important point to make, is that if you don't do those reductions, it can reduce the efficacy of the drug because of 2 reasons. One, you're not going to be able to continue with the same treatment, and maybe you stop because of that. And secondly, the patient might just refuse treatment and then say, I want to discontinue the treatment. So dose reductions are important to preserve quality of life, and dose reductions are not shown to compromise overall survival. Now, with having multiple treatment options, or increasingly multiple treatment options, then we have the ability to use sequential therapies that will try to do what we did in colon cancer, trying to improve survival. So we have that option now. And we talked about what do we do after gemcitabine-based treatment failure. And in the second line, the only FDA approval now we have for a regimen is the 5-FU and nab-paclitaxel based on the NAPOLI-1 trial in patients who failed gemcitabine-based therapy. And here, the combination has been shown to improve overall survival, but also progression-free survival with fairly well-tolerable toxicity. And then we have seen updates, and this benefit of survival has been maintained throughout. Now, there are studies, retrospective trials, that have looked into the use of, for example, gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel after FOLFIRINOX failure in a second-line setting. And here you have to be careful because those patients tend to have more side effects, and it's impossible to give the standard dose of gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel after FOLFIRINOX. So you have to be aware of that, and you will require dose reductions for that. And if you look at the outcomes, you still see a potential benefit for using the combination. So if we look at an algorithm or a graph to really look at the potential we have after treatment, in the front line, in patients, they can receive either FOLFIRINOX to start off with or gem-nab-paclitaxel, and there are more patients now getting on gem-nab-paclitaxel because FOLFIRINOX is still being reserved for the younger, fit patients because of the toxicity profile. But as I said earlier, any patient with metastatic disease has to be given both options. In the second line, after gem-nab-paclitaxel, FDA-approved regimen would be 5-FU leucovorin and NALIRI, or nanoliposome irinotecan. And there's also OFF, which is a regimen that was tested by Europeans, oxaliplatin and 5-FU. FOLFOX, which is currently used in second line by many people, in fact, doesn't have really good evidence. In fact, recent study from Canada showed that FOLFOX did worse than 5-FU-leucovorin, the control arm. So this is the data that we have to follow. Following FOLFIRINOX, there's no FDA-approved regimen, but the options are between gemcitabine or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Again, depending on performance status, patient preference, and also the neuropathy, which can be residual. In the third line, it becomes a bit more difficult. We don't have that many options. I know not many people go to third line, but there's still an option of using a platinum-based regimen if you're using NALIRI in the second line.
What about your sequence in a patient who receives neoadjuvant therapy with either NABGEM or FOLFIRINOX and then relapses shortly thereafter?
To me, that will depend very much on if you take the usual factors, performance status, organ function, etc. If you take everything out, I personally use the time between they finished the chemotherapy and they had the recurrence. If it's within less than 6 months, I don't use the same regimen. If it's after 6 months, then I would consider using the same regimen because I don't have many options. If it's after 1 year, then I certainly would go back, use the same regimen because I don't want to just dump an option because of it happened recurrence. So I still go back and use the same regimen.